Welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 13th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Prophetic Anger, Prophetic Hope, presented by Kim Winshaw. Let's listen in.
Task of the Prophet.
I think speaking truth to power is a definition that I have heard used.
That's a good one, especially today with Washington, D.C. as it is.
And isn't there like a level two of, I mean, not always, but sort of foreseeing into the future or how things could, not always, but I mean, in sort of Greek tradition and stuff, like when you have like a prophetess or something, that sometimes it involves having knowledge beyond, like greater spiritual knowledge and awareness to see how things might transpire in the future, but I don't know.
It can, in a lot of people's minds, that's what prophecy is about, is telling about what the future should be, but you're real close to the other thing I wanted to lift up, and that is that there's two sides to the true prophetic role. Anyone else want to comment here before I go on?
Well, I think you're swimming upstream as a prophetic. You can't be going with the flow.
Oh, for sure. you're critiquing the status quo, always. Yeah. There's a great book by Walter Brueggemann called The Prophetic Imagination that talks about the prophet having to call out the royal consciousness, you know, that maintains the status quo. But what I'm getting at with the two parts of being a prophet is the prophet critiques, laments, you know, rags on the people of God because they've turned away from God in some way. They're not doing justice, they're not taking care of the poor, the orphan, the widow, they're chasing after idols, you know, they're doing the wrong things. So the prophet tries to call them back to God. But it's not solely a critique, because if that's all it was, the people would be, you know, why would they be motivated to do anything? They'd just be sort of despairing of, oh, we're so bad. But what the prophet also does is hold out a hopeful vision of how things could be and tries
to
call
it,
people.
Right?
Pardon?
He has to live it also. Or doesn't he?
If you're a
prophet but you don't model it, then how does it work?
I would say the disciple is one who models.
Oh, okay.
The appropriate behavior. The prophet calls the people to task and laments and says, you know, you're screwing up royally. And in ecological terms, the interesting thing is if you read in like Hosea and Jeremiah and Isaiah, when the people are screwing up, the land is also suffering. Mm-hmm. And I've got a couple of texts to lift that up. But the point I wanted to make is that there's two sides to being a prophet. There's two parts of that task. And the one is to critique. The other is to hold out a vision of hope for what could be. Think of the vision in Isaiah, and I'll read that about the wolf and the lamb, and you know, nothing will be destroyed on all my holy mountain. They hold out that hopeful vision that draws people forward. Yeah.
You know what I think is, we're just so good at critiquing.
Oh, yes.
We're always talking about what's wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I don't know how we get by this. I mean, some of this we're going to talk about, but the best of us, you know, we know all the problems, and it's so easy. You get together with anybody and you start lamenting and talking about what's not any good, instead of, you know, even on that day you start talking, that you talk about some kind of vision.
Right.
But
what can we do? Exactly, and I think it took me a lot of years to realize that, because I came more of the environmental activist community, and that's, you know, we got to do this, we got to do that, we shouldn't do that, but the gift we have, I think, as people of faith to bring to this conversation is to hold out a hopeful vision. So let me just read a couple of examples of some texts here that lift these two sides up. First, the lament or critique. This is from Isaiah 24, verses 4 to 6. The earth mourns and withers. The world languishes and withers. The heavens languish together with the earth. The earth lies polluted under its inhabitants, for they have transgressed the laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. And this one from Jeremiah chapter 12, verse 4. How long will the land mourn and the grass of every field wither? For the wickedness of those who dwell in it, the beasts and the birds are swept away. Do those sort of images remind you of anything today, ecologically?
Can you hear those texts?
Isaiah 24, 4 to 6. in Jeremiah 12:4.
Well, when you see the smog in the cities and urbanization or the urban sprawl, how it's taking up land,
mm-hmm.
and there's no place for the animals.
Yeah.
So many things, or the deforestation then causes landslides and mudslides, and I mean, all those kind of things that if there would have been some forethought,
yeah.
may not have happened.
Mm-hmm. The birds and the beasts are swept away.
Mm-hmm.
This text came into play a little bit yesterday because we were talking about biblical texts that can sort of be foundations for earth keeping. And when I was reading the one about, things withering, someone was thinking of global warming, for instance. And another comment that a fellow had was, in these texts where it's talking about the people messing up and the land suffering, he said that that also pointed to the fact that they were so much more intimately connected with the land. Which I thought was an interesting insight that was new for me. Any other thoughts on those two? There's a bunch of texts. There's also a really good one in Hosea about even the fish of the sea are perishing. it's real vivid images of the land and its creatures suffering because of the things people are doing when they've turned away from God. Here's another one I want to counterbalance with. Sometimes I when I look at these, I look for the modern ecological echo, you might say. And in this case, it was something I had read in a magazine first, and when I read the thing in the magazine, it reminded me immediately of this verse from Jeremiah that I'm going to read to you next. This is from Jeremiah 8, verse 7. Even the stork in the heavens knows her times, and the turtle dove, swallow, and crane keep the time of their coming, migrate. But my people know not the ordinance of the Lord. Seems to me it's almost kind of like a head-smacking thing. Even the stork in the heavens knows the time of its coming. All right. So this little quote is from an article in 1998, a magazine called Yes Magazine. The article was called Changing the Climate, the Global Warming Crisis by Ross Gelbspan, who's written a lot of articles and a book or two on this. He writes that in the spring of 1998, when the storks were returning to northern Europe after wintering in Africa, they encountered a bizarre weather pattern. Northern Germany and Poland were caught in the grip of an extended spell of drought and frost. Their migratory instincts confounded, the storks turned back and began flying in wide circles over Turkey and the Balkans, until hundreds dropped out of the sky, dead from exhaustion. And you know, when I put those two together, even the stork knows the time of its coming, but my people don't know the ordinance of the Lord. And I just thought that was awfully painful. Any comments to that?
And what was the timing of that?
The timing of the article?
Yeah, the event that they were writing about.
Probably in the late 90s.
In the late 90s.
Right,
okay.
Right. And that, well, I'm looking at it from today's point of view, here we are today and we're still kind of fiddling around on that issue. That'll come up tonight in the forum. But I just want to get you to think about a sense of how those ancient texts talk about people messing up and the earth suffering, and how that holds true today in a different sort of way. Different but not different, you know, because our modern ecological problems are not what they had back then. But it shows you the potential for, the need for prophets today, you know, for eco-prophets that speak both to the church and to society. And try to give them an idea of things they could do, but then we need to also get into the hopeful vision part. So here's a couple of texts that are more on the hopeful side. See what these say to you. This is from Ezekiel chapter 47, verses like 9, 11, and 12. Kind of like this up here. Talking about the river of the water of life flowing from the temple. Wherever the river goes, every living creature that swarms will live. And there will be very many fish once these waters reach there. It will become fresh, and everything will live where the river goes. But its swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They are to be left for salt. On the banks on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither nor their fruit fail, but they will bear fresh fruit every month because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food and leaves for healing. From Isaiah 11, verses 6 to 7 and 9. The wolf shall live with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. They will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. What kind of vision were the prophets trying to hold out to people then?
Unity and harmony.
Pardon?
Unity and harmony.
Yeah.
Kind of life abundant.
Yeah, yeah.
Which sometimes you get worried we have life abundant compared to so many others. The use of life abundant kind of concerns me sometimes.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. I think it only comes if we equate life abundant with having a lot of stuff. Having a lot of stuff. Is that what's true abundance? Right. I mean, when you think of how we all live here, we're living fairly simply and in community, and I would say we'd all call it very abundant. Do you think? But in a richer, different way.
Well, then we have the opposite, the concern about you shall have life abundant. Has so many taken it as...
You'll have a lot of stuff.
Yeah, well, or privilege and, all of that.
Yeah.
We're fine, in a particular country, I think, makes that pretty strong.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. So how would a prophet put that on a hopeful spin today and get people to find a new definition for abundant life? Is there a way to do that? What hopeful vision do we try? Would we want to call people to today?
More compassion.
Yeah.
More caring for the earth.
Yeah.
All of that goes into real life abundance. I don't think lots of people see it at all. The connection.
No, they don't.
We have what we want.
What do you think? What is the quality of life here that makes it abundant? And how can we translate that into a vision back home? Is there a way to do that? And I'm asking you too because I don't totally know the answer. But you know what I mean?
I think when you question what people really value and what makes people happy, and they actually take time to think about those questions, mm-hmm. they would acknowledge that it's not the things in their house or the vacations they take or whatever, but it's the people and the relationships the good things that come from the non-consumer type of good things that we have. But I think it takes some honest reflection and questioning to realize those values that I think most people would admit to once they took time.
If they think about it.
And what they're actually seeking in life is probably more happiness through relationships and, rather than the things that they could buy.
I appreciate that. And I think, from my point of view, a lot of environmental problems or degradations stem from the fact that too often people perceive themselves as separate from the rest of the world and from one another. They have this sort of utilitarian view of the world. But the opposite view is the one of interrelationship. And that's something I think we really can lift up as people of faith. I mean, there's the text about, in Christ all things hold together. It's all about interrelationship.
Well, also it seems important to give people a chance to experience the environment. I mean, there's so many, kids, especially people who are born in cities and, especially because of economic circumstances or a variety of different reasons, just that's their reality. And so then to expect people who have never been to a place like Wilderness gone on hikes or gone fishing or had that be an integral part of what's important to them, to then ask those people to be like, well, why are you not standing up for the environment? Well, if it's never done anything for you. I mean, you know, if you just have no relationship to it.
Sure. Sure, the physical context is such that they don't have that interaction and are separate for other reasons. There's more of an issue of survival sometimes than enjoying a walk in the woods. You know, we're kind of spoiled that way, some of us.
Yeah,
that's true.
One of the things in terms of the question you asked about what can we take out of Holden Village to the outside community is, in some respects for me, is a problem because there's such an overwhelming trend in so many of the Christian faiths to use the voice of prayer to ask for things. And I find this in a lot of the evangelical organizations in the business community. You go to a business luncheon and they pray and they ask people to pray, to ask for the job that you want, to ask for the money that you want, ask for the blessings of these things. And it's very difficult to transition from what God has given us here at Holden Village and take it out to that community where the mindset has become so distorted and so directed in a different setting from what we know here. And that's the thing that, for me, is the prophetic anger, is how do I go out and talk to these people in a voice that, you know, it's like crying in the wilderness.
Well, it's, and see, I don't know how many of you are Lutheran here, but what I'm thinking of when you're talking about that is what Luther would call the theology of glory, as opposed to the theology of the cross. You know, and I don't know that you can convert people like that, that are seeing it that way. Maybe is part of the answer in just connecting with and affirming and encouraging those ones who feel as we do in a way, and letting them know they're not alone, and let's grow this circle of Earth community. Say, there's a magazine out right now that I've been showing everyone I talk to. This is another copy of Yes Magazine where I took that quote from some years ago, but this is the newest one. It says 5,000 years of empire, ready for a change? And it talks about a new, part of the focus is on a new book by David Corton, who wrote a book, When Corporations Rule the World, some years ago. He has a new one out now called The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. And to me, that's all the same. It's the utilitarian, separate worldview, theology of glory, empire, dominance. You know, and over here is Earth Community and partnership and collaboration and relationship, you know.
As you were talking, it just really struck me because Jesus taught community. I mean, that was really his model, is to live in community and harmony, and that was always his invitation. And he empowered people to know their truth and to believe in it, and to trust what God has given them. And also, you know, in all his parables, we're certainly integrated with the with nature. So it just seems to me that once Christianity became in legalized or in an institution, we went into this empire.
It took on empire.
Empire. So, and we really sort of forgot what it is that Jesus is calling us to. I know now Holden, this is a wonderful community, and we do have community, but I think, well, I don't come out of the Lutheran tradition, I come out of the Catholic tradition, but it seems to me that the hierarchical structure has this, sort of is missing in some aspects the community aspect, and it's because it's an institution. So I'm just really, I read that article and I was quite taken with it, and I think that is our duty to speak out for the community and our relationship with nature and with everyone. And I think in some sense that will also reduce our violence that we experience in our world.
In Seattle, we have the Earth Ministry.
Yeah, I know of that wonderful group.
Just
wonderful.
A group that really discusses community and ministry.
Hello?
Are you familiar with, you probably are familiar with, just when I want a name, I can't get it, the guy in Kentucky.
Wendell Berry.
Yeah.
I mean, he's probably the ultimate living and describing what community is.
Yeah.
He's stayed there all his life. He's been a farmer all his life, as well as the poet.
Yeah.
And calling to people constantly about paying more attention to things.
Yeah. I don't know if any of you are real familiar with that, but out in the Northwest here too, I remember hearing a few years ago that the, I think, I want to say it's the religious leaders or bishops in the area came up with like a pastoral statement on the Columbia River watershed as a sacramental commons. I forget what it's called, but that to me, I'm guessing, is something that was holding out a hopeful vision for what the people out in this part of the country could aspire to. You know, a sustainable community relationship among the themselves and the different economies that involve natural resources, but also the creation itself.
I was going to say, too, when you were talking about how to bring some of these ideas to other people, and I think the things that have impacted me the most are relationships with people outside of the U.S. and hearing the story of people from Pacific Islands that have already now applied for refugee status because it's quite likely that their island will be, you know, the water will be rising so much that they won't be able to remain on their islands.
Yeah.
And so hearing stories like that when I read, you know, headlines in the newspaper about global warming doesn't affect me nearly the same way as knowing people who will be so directly impacted by something so abstract as global warming. And so building those relationships with or meeting farmers who grow bananas in Central America or whatever, it's those kind of experiences that are so important in really understanding some of that interconnection too.
Yeah.
And so ways that we can build those relationships and understand people as part of our global community in that kind of cliche term, but in a true sense. So, so that when we do things in our own communities, we recognize what's beyond.
And the hopeful stories as well, I think,
right,
is part of what you were saying, yeah.
People up here at Holden get their food a lot from the people in the proximity to Holden here. But I wonder if that is noted, if people know that when they come here. I've heard it, but I don't hear people really, you know, I think it would be good for some kind of information place so that as people come up here, they'll realize that's an example of how live with where you are,
right,
with
the
food.
You know, sometimes that's on the bulletin board, the dining hall.
But in what way? What do they say when they're doing that?
They
usually, it's not there. I think you're right, it should be up this year. It's not. But usually there's a bulletin board related to food that says, here are Holdens, this is what we believe in about food, that it builds community, and so that we here are the farms specifically that we get food from, this is why we've made these choices, and what, you know, like, here's why we don't have as much meat, because we believe in eating lower on the food chain, and how, they usually have the whole food philosophy up there, but it's not there.
Well, and it probably should be highlighted once a week, you know, people.
We've even had food forums on the whole idea of best Holden food.
Or something like when information when they first come or something, because I think
it's in the notebook too that's in the room, so it's available.
Oh,
yeah.
Very good.
That food, did you call it?
I'll show you where that is in the chalet.
Yeah, but it could be.
But yeah, I just think we've got such a good example that it needs to get kind of touted more, you know, like not just it's in the book.
Yeah.
Right. Because I heard people talking about, oh, I wonder if cherries are as bad with pesticides as strawberries. And I was like, well, actually, those are locally grown organic cherries because I saw the box. So.
Yeah.
But, you know, people, so there are still that.
I think it could be a teaching sort of thing for them to be aware of where it comes from. I assumed, because I knew you all were ecologically responsible here, I assumed it probably came from local, but it would be teaching for a lot of people. Something I want to share with you from this, from one of these articles, you know, talking about sort of what the empire mentality is, you know, this, I thought this was important, what he lifted up in one part. It was titled, this section, Break the Silence and the Isolation, Change the Story. He said, we humans live by stories. The key to making a choice for Earth community is recognizing that the foundation of Empire's power does not lie in its instruments of physical violence. It lies in Empire's ability to control the stories by which we define ourselves and our possibilities. And he lists three types of stories that the Imperial Empire powers kind of use, right? The Imperial prosperity story, an eternally growing economy benefits everyone. The Imperial security story tells of a dangerous world. The only way to ensure our safety is through major expenditures on the military and the police to maintain order. The Imperial meaning story reinforces the other two, featuring a god who rewards righteousness with wealth and power and mandates that they rule over the poor who justly suffer divine punishment for their sins. So he's saying that's the stories that undergird Empire. He said, these stories all serve to alienate us from the community of life and deny the positive potentials of our nature, while affirming the legitimacy of economic inequality, the use of physical force to maintain imperial order, and the special righteousness of those in power. Gotta love that line. So he talks about in the great turning, then away from this, you look for a cultural turning that's a cultural and spiritual awakening. An economic turning in terms of your values, what you value, you know, in terms of what makes life abundant, I guess. You know, to redefine wealth, to measure it by the health of our families, communities, and natural environment. And the policies that would raise those at the bottom, you know, move from hoarding to sharing, from the rights of ownership to the responsibilities of stewardship. And also a political turning that goes from a $1, one vote democracy to a one person, one vote democracy, from passive to active citizenship, from competition to cooperation. But he makes the point that we humans live by stories, and to change the human future, we must change our defining stories. So I think that's a good way of naming today's prophetic hopeful vision. Let me turn just a little bit here to, let's look at some, if we can, some concrete examples of anger and hope, maybe, in terms of environmental stuff. For any of you out there, what's today, what issues, what makes you angry? What gives you grief? For me, it's global warming. Time magazine, be worried, be very worried. One of several. You all, what makes you angry or...
Drilling for oil in the wilderness.
Yes, stay out of Anwar. Yes. Others, what's your...
It's not only oil, it's also drilling for natural gas in the Rocky Mountain front.
The issues and headlines, yeah.
Walmart makes me... they just control their suppliers, and they're not stopped,
right?
Because money rules.
Have you heard the hopeful stories, though, of communities that have stood up against them and kept them out? I know it's not many. Other issues, headlines, ecological terms.
In terms of oil, like subsidies for oil, and you know, paying not only drilling more, but also making it easier and easier to get it, or going to war. You know, partially in response to, so the effects that controls even the lives of people like that too.
Yeah.
So it's the need for something that isn't necessarily necessary to actually kill people and to ruin.
Well, and the fact that we depend on oil, we should not depend on it as much as we do. Isn't it true that car companies have patents for something,
alternative fuels and things that they haven't been acting on?
We have the technology to not use oil in cars, but why isn't it done?
Politics and money and
other like issues of solar panel projects being like going forward and being almost ready to implement and then being stopped because of government, you know, policies.
So
things that would have actually really made a big impact and change, but then getting caught up in the money and politics.
So this is good because I think we're all touching base with that angry stuff in us that we're seeing what's going on in society, and we want to, you know, voice our anger about it and make something different happen.
It's been going on for an incredibly long period of time, because
exactly.
People don't realize that the automotive industry in the United States, General Motors, bought out all of Stanley Steemer's patents for the steam-driven automobile, and refused to bring it out as a product that could have been used instead of the gasoline engines
really?
That we
wow.
have now. I mean, Stanley in 1910 had an automobile that was so incredible in performance that it just made all the other automobiles look inferior, and General Motors bought up all the patents for it.
Wow. You know, I've never heard that. I hear Stanley Steemer and I think of the rug cleaning
right.
people.
There was something on TV about the electric cars that have been made in the past, and then again they kind of got dropped as far as making them more possible.
Yeah.
It's hard to remember all the details of why,
yeah.
but it's kind of all that comes into, instead of as a whole team, kind of as a government,
yeah.
what could be done. Everybody has to start to struggle to get to some things that are possible, and it would be much better.
What would you say?
Too many greedy people. I mean,
exactly.
I'm trying not to throw
exactly.
stone, but
nope, that's
money
totally.
Is king. Money is what they worship.
Yeah.
And it just, that
makes me angry. We're going to turn to the hopeful part here. Well, it's all about
modified genetic foods.
Yeah.
I mean, that for me, is another really. I don't even know what to say. Dilemma isn't even the word, but I mean, it's just, it's because it's destroying, and we don't even know what it is going to do in the future.
Right.
But for the moment, it's not only destroying the ecology, but it's also livelihood of human beings, the farmers. And so it's, and there's really no necessity for it. And like Horton said, we hear the wrong, we hear the story that this modified foods are so good because they're more nutritious, and you can plant more because you know they're perfectly designed, so you can harvest more, but those are really all lies. And
well, there's been a lot of distortion on genetic engineering of foods. I mean, genetic engineering of food has been a natural process just in nature itself for hundreds of thousands of years with cross-pollination that's occurred between plants. So it's how it's used in terms of products that are made available for us to consume, and it creates a product that they can use in the greedy marketing process. That's the tragedy that has to be very carefully observed, not necessarily just genetic engineering.
Right. Thank you. We're going to need to turn into the hope a little bit, and we'll run out of time before we get hopeful, which wouldn't be good. So there's definitely a role for the church in these things, speaking truth to power, as someone said before. Some of the most empowered feeling advocacy I've done is when I've gone with a group of church people to Washington, D.C., and we go in and do lobbying. We call it advocacy because we're speaking on behalf of. We're not doing it, you know, for some money company. But we speak from the position of our faith, you know, and we say we have real concerns about climate change and energy use, and this is why, you know, and we talk about the impacts to creation, we talk about the justice issues of the people that are in the low-lying island nations and things like that. We really, as people of faith, have a powerful voice that we don't use as much as we should. Some people of faith have too much power in terms of voice right now in Washington, but the people that aren't the empire, the people that aren't the theology of glory folks, the rest of us, that's probably one of the more important things we can do right now, those of us that think this way, is encourage folks to write their legislators, call them, get together, do little meetings, you know, with them. Let them know there is another religious viewpoint on these things. All right, something I wanted to bring up to try and get at the anger and the hope, both. I went to see, and I don't know if many of you have seen this yet, but Al Gore's movie about climate change and Inconvenient Truth, just opened not too long ago. I highly recommend it. Watching that movie, And something like this too, Time Magazine devoting a whole lot of attention to climate change and saying, you know, finally the media is saying, yes, it's happening, it's real, humans are contributing to it, et cetera, et cetera. For so long the media would say, well, you know, some scientists say this and some scientists say that. The problem for years has been there's been hundreds, if not thousands, of scientists over here and like five or less on the other side. I knew all their names because they pop up again and again in articles. Oil funded their research. Media made it look like it was an equal field, you know, that there was all this debate. There's not been debate for, you know, probably close to 10 years. Among serious scientists, there's not been debate. So when I went to the movie, in some ways it was heartbreaking to me that it's taken this long. You know, I've been engaged in this in climate change related work seriously since 98. So in some ways it was heartbreaking to me that it's taken this long for the media, for even more politicians to actually start saying, yes, global warming is real, people are contributing to it, we need to do something. You know, a couple of spots in the movie, I was ready to put my head in my hands, especially the polar bear animation. Polar bear flying and the ice floes cracking and the polar bear, you know, is gonna drown because that's what's happening to them up there now because they're losing their ice sheet where they need to hunt from. And just the animation alone really was real powerful. But the hope, and they talk in scientific terms about a tipping point, we're maybe reaching a tipping point on climate change where it's going to be so messy, it'll be hard to turn it back. But what I also see very much is a tipping point of awareness that it is being talked about. People are doing some sustainable energy sorts of things. Politicians more and more are talking about. There was a resolution in the Senate this past year called a Sense of the Senate. Didn't actually do anything, but they all approved that we need to do something definite to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. And that was really kind of a huge thing. It doesn't actually do anything yet, but for them to vote that yes, we need to do something. So there's new media attention to global warming. The evangelicals there's an evangelical environmental network that's been working hard for a number of years. They got a bunch of top evangelical leaders to sign a letter about, what's it say here? Our commitment to Jesus Christ compels us to solve the global warming crisis. And they have the ear of Washington. They're making them nervous. I have a couple other hopeful examples, and then if you all have some, I want you to chime in. Hopeful things that I've seen going on. The Warren Buffett, Bill Gates thing, where they're joining together to do philanthropic, you know, things in third world countries. An article, a story a couple of years ago in the news about people sighting again the ivory-billed woodpecker in the forest down by Arkansas. They thought it had been extinct for like 50 years. And some people saw one again, and the fellow cried when he saw it, you know. What else? There was the one about the whale in the Thames River this past winter. Did you hear that story? They don't see whales there. It was like below Big Ben, you know, 15 miles up in the river. And people came out and lined the bridges, and they were all concerned about this whale and, you know, watching it. And finally they decided it wasn't going to find its way back to the ocean, so they put it on a barge, and they're trying to truck it the 3 or 5 hours back out to sea. And people lined the bridges, hundreds of them, thousands of them, applauding and cheering, you know, and feeling their connection with creation. And at one point as the barge was going out, the lights went off on it, and that's because the whale had died, and the people were crying that were on the barge trying to take it out. But even in that moment of sadness, where I see the hope in that, and the neat thing is that people felt that connection, you know. So it's out there, it's alive. It's just we need the stories to alert people to it, I think. I don't know, do you have any hopeful stories that you know of that way?
Yeah. In the Quad Cities, there's a teenager named Chad Cracky, and perhaps you've heard of him. He started at age 16, 17 with a flat bottom boat, cleaning out parts of the Mississippi. And he's just a kid, just a teenager. I mean, you know. And he has now organized so that he owns a couple barges, a couple tugboats. He's cleaned up huge sections of the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Ohio. Paul, what other rivers?
Illinois, and now he's going to Russia.
Yeah. One young teenager has made a huge difference in cleaning up our rivers.
Wow.
He was pulling out stuff just by himself, getting eaten by mosquitoes, and now he has a team, these teams.
Yeah.
Been to Washington, you know, now getting some actual money to do it. And one teenager, a person can make a difference.
That's really cool.
There has been a positive in the Pacific Ocean with the federal court's ruling that the Navy had to discontinue the use of their sonar in the area where they were impacting marine mammals.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And their naval exercise, there was a special naval exercise planned for this month, a joint effort on several nations, and they were forced to move out of the area where they were planning to use their extremely powerful sonars.
That's great.
And the government is now finally reconsidering CAFE standards, I think, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, corporate automobile
slowly,
fuel efficiency. And it hasn't been, it's lowered. It was 22, I think, when Jimmy Carter was in office, and now it's down to 20 or something like that.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, in part, the senators in Michigan have been laggards on that, I have to confess. But I think we're getting to something good here, because maybe the prophetic hope part for us is in part, I'm losing it now, it by what we model, by our actions, you know, and tell the stories of those. But also, that's how we hold out the hopeful vision, is by what we do. There's a Catholic parish in Michigan that on the rectory roof, they have two wind turbines and a solar panel. And we've given a lot of attention in Michigan. I was there. We did a press conference, actually, because we have a state interfaith climate and energy campaign in Michigan. And we did a press conference there and invited the media to take a picture of this. And the Catholic priest of the parish climbed up a ladder to the rectory roof and blessed them with holy water. And we made up like a blessing. A rabbi helped with the one for the solar panels, and I came up with a little one for the wind turbine. So we read those blessings, and he blessed them. And you know, the really cool thing too that day was the wind turbine had not been turning. There wasn't much of a breeze. And just as the father blessed it, a puff of wind came and started to turn. Though maybe that's the sorts of stories. You know, we need to tell those stories. We need to model those stories. In congregations, they can do an energy audit and find how they can use less energy. Cutting their energy use, cutting their bills, use that money for other ministries. Announce it in the paper, you know.
I think the number of Priuses, I mean, I think I live in a kind of unique part of the United States, but regardless, the number of people buying Priuses, which actually do cost more, even though you save money on fuel, in the long run still apparently costs you more than a regular new car. So the willingness of people to say, no, it is worth it because of emissions and other things too. It's not, when it comes down to it, it's not the bottom line of, is it going to cost me more, but do I want to make a stance and do something that's better?
So it makes a statement, a visible statement, a witness. In religious terms, you'd say it's a witness.
In a way, for some people, you know, it's not a witness that everybody can make.
Well, but people of faith, if they do that sort of thing, or say that your church, your congregation had a carpool to church Sunday, you know, or walk to church Sunday, depending where it's at. Take pictures. Get a photographer from the local paper to come out and do that. So I guess you try and take the actions, tell the stories, and publicize the hopeful parts.
Media.
Call the media. Yeah, call the media. Any other comments right here? I'll kind of wind this into a closing part.
I was just going to say that this is, I work with a group of seminary students who are involved in ecological ethics, we call it. But we've had a couple sessions this year where we've talked about this notion of the need for environmental activists and people concerned to be hopeful and to celebrate instead of always being naysayers, because that has been most people's experience with environmentalists they always say no, they always tell us not to do things, they tell us to stop
say
doing
what's
things.
Wrong.
And and they give us doomsday reports about what's going to happen. And so I think especially for Christians to make statements that aren't only naysaying and scare tactics, but really do point out hopeful ideas and point to the values of community and sharing, rather than just this is what's going to happen if we don't do anything.
Yeah.
But to the hopeful alternatives, that's a hugely important part of what it means for Christian witness, I think, in this world of environmental concern. So.
Totally. And other concerns of society, too. I'm
right.
thinking in a way part of that might be part of the way to revitalize Lutheran churches outside of Holden, you know, if you can get that sort of feeling going. I mean, when you think of the worship services that we have in the evening at Vespers, you know, people would want to come to that sort of thing.
And we did like a Earth Day celebration liturgy instead of a very like somber, this is what's going to happen, you know, but to celebrate what is good about creation and what we do value in terms of that, so that not everything is the negative side.
What was your group's name?
It's called Trees.
No, you said some other phrase.
Yeah, well, it's Theological Roundtable on Ecological Ethics and Spirituality.
Hey. Oh, that's great.
Trees.
It's great to get a little simple.
Kind of annoying because it's a really long
thing. To explain it out is annoying, but once they know what it is, that's cool. What's
that? I graduate Theological Union.
Cool. That's very cool. Let me just point this out, too, that I think in terms of motivating us to earthkeeping or caring for the earth, it can come from two sources. It can come from the celebration part, the joy, the awe, the wonder, the gratitude, you know, for everything that's out there. But it also can flow out of our grief and concern and all that. Because when you're feeling that, you're in a stance of compassion as opposed to apathy. Apathy is, you know, indifference, and sometimes it's an intentional apathy. You don't want to know about it. But sometimes, more often than not, I think it's an apathy of, you'll be overwhelmed otherwise. You know, what could I possibly do? So it's just easier to not get that involved. But the opposite of apathy is compassion, which means with feeling or to suffer with. And when you can allow yourself to enter into that grief and to suffer with, it's like a channel opens within you that God can work through. God's grace can work through you to bring healing to the world in some kind of way. So both the joy of creation and the pain of creation can really move you to do something. Because when you, something will appear before you that you uniquely can do, you or your group or your church or your job, you know, your workplace, there's something that the Spirit will direct you that you can do. Like that boy, you know, I mean, not everyone's going to do that, but there's something you can do. Let me read you just a short little three-line sort of poem thing that's good. And then I got one other thing. This is by a poet named Adrienne Rich. You might know her. My heart is moved by all I cannot save, so much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those who age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world. I just love that. Finally, I want to say that, did you know that God calls all of us to be prophets in some way? And I didn't know that either until I heard this rabbi talking about prophets. A wonderful story he gave to all of us. I mean, none of us were Jewish, but this was in Washington, D.C., and it was like a workshop about being prophetic, basically. And he said, how did he put it? He said, do you know what the responses are of the prophet is when God first calls? But there's two responses, most typically. I think with one prophet it wasn't that way, but what is the typical prophetic response when God calls someone to be a prophet?
Not me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to him.
Who me? I'm not qualified, right? I can't do that, you know.
Moses said it too.
Yeah, most of them did. I stutter, you know, I don't know what to say. Who me, you know, who me? But then what the rabbi said, he said, would our God call someone so arrogant to think that they were qualified?
That's good.
Wait, and the rabbi, he said it in a funnier way, but that was basically it. You know, would God call someone who was that arrogant? So the second response of the prophet is,
here I am, send me.
There you go. Perfect. I got that typed right on my paper, but you said
it. I couldn't read it either.
It's far away. Got it in the quotes there. So I think if we just open ourselves to the joy and wonder of creation, but also open ourselves in a compassionate sense to the pain of creation, God will call you, and there's something that you can do. I have a prayer to end with that works good here. Are we cool with that? We'll go to prayer. So let's pray. Lord God, you have called your servants to ventures of which we cannot see the ending, by paths as yet untrodden, through perils unknown. Give us faith to go out with good courage, not knowing where we go, but only that your hand is leading us and your love supporting us. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you. And I've got these magazines up here if you want to look at these.
Very good.